The Thomistic Institute's Aquinas 101 program is bringing the truth of the Catholic faith to millions every year, but it's only possible because of support from listeners like you. Aquinas 101 is entirely audience-funded. Each episode exists thanks to your generosity. Will you help make the next one possible with a small gift? Visit ThomisticInstitute.org/donate to learn more. That's ThomisticInstitute.org/donate.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
I'd like to begin with this quote from the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith's 2020 letter, Samaritanus Bonus, which is on end-of-life ethics, which connects Christ's suffering on the cross in particular to the suffering of the sick and the dying. So it says, "The nearness of the God made man is manifest in the living experience of Christ's suffering, of his agony on the cross and his resurrection. His experience of multiple forms of pain and anguish resonates with the sick and their families during the long days of infirmity that precede the end of life." So we've discussed in the previous talks how in suffering well, we can contribute to our own salvation and the salvation of others, and how suffering can unleash love in the world when others suffer with those who suffer. But we also discussed how suffering is an experience of evil, and so how it is permissible and even good to work to alleviate suffering. So the question for this talk is, how can we rightfully alleviate suffering? To answer these questions, I'll be taking you through Catholic teaching on medical treatment decision-making, and I will examine along the way how considerations of suffering rightly and wrongly factor in. Then we'll turn to Catholic teaching on euthanasia and palliative care. I'd like to begin by telling you about a patient that I had during my time working in the hospital. So we'll call her Jenny. So Jenny was a 40-year-old woman who had moved to the U.S. about 15 years prior from another country. She's married and she has four children. I believe the younger ones were with them in the U.S. while the older ones were still back in their home country. She's diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer, and she was given four treatment paths. She offered just simply pain control, given that the cancer was incurable, so she could forgo cancer-oriented treatment and just pursue pain medication. Or she could do pain medication in conjunction with cancer-directed treatment. So the options for that would be chemotherapy, which couldn't cure the cancer, but could aim to slow the growth of the cancer, make her tumors smaller, so possibly extend her life by some amount of time. And then radiation was presented as a sort of in-between option, and it was made clear that the radiation wouldn't slow the growth of the cancer, but it could help reduce her pain in sort of like this in-between way. So one question with respect to Jenny is, does Jenny need to have chemotherapy, given that it could extend her life, even if for only a short amount of time? And thinking about this case from a Catholic perspective, you think about maybe there's a spectrum in terms of how people might approach the case. So it's not, this is not from a Catholic perspective, but if you think about where Catholic teaching falls on this spectrum, on one end of the spectrum, we have what we might call a subjectivist perspective, which would say that morality is entirely a matter of personal choice. And so Jenny could do whatever she wanted to do. She could pursue chemo, she could forgo chemo, she could do radiation, she could forgo radiation, she could pursue pain medication. Maybe she might also request physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia. On the other side of the spectrum, we have what's sometimes referred to as a medical vitalist position. So this is the idea that we should preserve life at all costs. So insofar as Jenny has an option, namely chemotherapy, which will help to extend her life, even if only briefly, that she has an obligation to pursue that treatment. So again, what is the Catholic position? Does Jenny need to go through chemo? Any sense for where the Catholic position falls on the spectrum? So I don't know how many of you are familiar with Catholic teaching and medical treatment decision making, but what would you say? Yes.
I mean, it's really secular.
Okay.
I don't think the Catholic Church, like CS or Catholic medical teaching, has a real say. I know that it's always up to, like, medical treatment doesn't have to be a burden, I know, financially, so people can choose not to if they don't want to.
Okay, so some of what you said is correct, and some of what you said isn't quite correct, or at least might be misleading, so we'll make those corrections, but other ideas? Yes?
I think I've always heard the word reasonable used. I don't know if it's like reasonable care.
Okay, so you have some sense of like, well, maybe it doesn't really fall on either ends of the spectrum. Maybe we don't always have to pursue treatment. This is right. This is correct. So the Catholic position, I mean, if you were to, again, try to put it on the spectrum, it doesn't really fall at either end here. Here's a quote from the Ethical and Religious Directives for Catholic Healthcare Services, which is a mouthful, so we usually call them the ERDs, but it's essentially a summary of Catholic teaching on bioethics issues that is published by the U.S. Catholic bishops. So here's what the ERDs say. The truth that life is a precious gift from God has profound implications for the question of stewardship over human life. We are not the owners of our lives and hence do not have absolute power over life. We have a duty to preserve our life and to use it for the glory of God. But the duty to preserve life is not absolute, for we may reject life-prolonging procedures that are insufficiently beneficial or excessively burdensome. Suicide and euthanasia are never morally acceptable options. So it's certainly not a subjectivist perspective. So as the last line makes clear, and we'll talk more about later in the talk, the Catholic Church is clear that it's always wrong directly to take innocent human life, even if there's a good intention to alleviate suffering, as in the case of physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia. And it's also not subjectivist in the sense that there's also a positive duty, right, that's binding on us, which is that we need to promote the goods of life and health. But it's also not a vitalist position, right? So life is a gift from God, but it makes very clear here the duty to preserve our lives is not absolute. We don't need to do everything possible to promote our health, to preserve our lives. So rather, just like the promotion of any goods, the duty to promote the goods of life and health are in the realm of prudence. Prudence, maybe you have a definition in mind. Catechism says is the virtue that helps us to know the true good in the circumstances and the right means of achieving it, right? So the true goods here are life and health, but what are the right means of achieving those goods? That's also a matter of prudence. So we think about another example, right? Here we're kind of thinking about the use of medical technology as a means, right? And whether that's the right means in the circumstance. If we think about exercise as another means, maybe it comes a little clearer to us, right? Where, we think we have a duty to promote our lives and our health. But as far as like the duty to exercise, like, that we have to take other things into account. Generally, it's good to get exercise, right? But there are other things that we need to factor in, right? So we have to factor in our other obligations that we have in life. We need to factor in the state of our health, right? So different things have to be factored in order to determine, the prudence. We can also exercise too much, right? So there are different factors here as far as how to promote the good with respect to the means of exercise. So likewise, prudence also helps us to discern when, how, and to what extent we should preserve our lives when it comes to medical treatment decisions. So again, I think we might say that the Catholic position falls somewhere in between these two ends of the spectrum. But what does somewhere in between mean? What more can we say about Catholic medical treatment medical treatment decision making? So the Catholic tradition distinguishes between what are called ordinary means and extraordinary means. Ordinary means are also called proportionate means, and these are morally obligatory, whereas extraordinary means are also called disproportionate means. I'll explain why in a moment. And these refer to medical treatments that are morally optional. So the distinction is a moral distinction. It's not a medical distinction. When we talk about means, we're talking about treatments. And this distinction can be used when discerning whether to withdraw a treatment that has already been started or to withhold a treatment that hasn't yet been started. Sometimes there's sort of an intuition that once we start a treatment, we can't stop it. But that's not correct, that from a Catholic perspective, we can have, sometimes it's actually easier to make a decision to stop a treatment just because it's clear just what the different considerations are once we've started a treatment. So what makes a treatment ordinary or extraordinary? Oops, sorry, I forgot to put that up. So medically speaking, again, I'm giving you the moral understanding of these terms, but these terms are also used medically, and so it gets confusing. These are not the only terms in Catholic bioethics that have both moral senses and medical senses. But when we talk about ordinary means in a medical sense, we typically have in mind treatments that are available, effective, standard of care. So the moral sense of ordinary means, I would say, includes these, right? So these are sort of necessary conditions for a medical treatment to be an ordinary means, but they're not sufficient. Here's what the ERDs say ordinary means are. Ordinary means, or proportionate means, are those that in the judgment of the patient offer a reasonable hope of benefit and do not entail excessive burden or impose excessive expense on the family or the community. Extraordinary means are just the opposite. They do not entail a reasonable hope of benefit, or they entail an excessive burden, or impose excessive expense on the family or the community. One thing to note is the language of in the judgment of the patient, right? So I think to go back to, I'm sorry, I don't know your name when you first answered my question. James, when James said it's up to the patient, right? There's some truth in that. There are limits to that, right? Like we saw with physician-assisted suicide euthanasia, so the patient can't just choose anything. But the patient's perspective is important, certainly. The ERDs draw our attention to this. Why is the patient's perspective important? Well, the patient knows best what the benefits and burdens of a treatment will be for him or her, typically, right? So sometimes we have patients who aren't able to make their own decisions. In the case of children or adults who have lost decisional capacity or maybe never had it because of disability. And so in that case, the decision maker is going to try to make decisions as much as possible from the perspective of the patient, in the best interest of the patient. But typically, the patient does know best, right? The patient knows best all the different considerations to kind of factor into this discernment. And they also know how they weigh different benefits and burdens against each other, right? So whether there is an excessive burden, to some extent, that's a decision that has to be made from the person's own perspective. So there's some objectivity to it, like it has to be kind of like reasonable, but people do judge things a little differently sometimes, right? Okay, so just to simplify things, ordinary means, again, offer a reasonable hope of benefit, and they don't entail excessive burden. So both of those conditions have to be met for a treatment to be morally obligatory. If either one of the conditions isn't met, so if there is no reasonable hope of benefit, or even if there's a reasonable hope of benefit, but there's an excessive burden, then the treatment becomes extraordinary. The Catholic tradition also speaks of weighing benefits and burdens. And so this is where the language of proportionate and disproportionate means comes in, right? So proportionate ordinary means are those where the burdens are proportionate to the benefits. And then disproportionate, that language comes in because the burdens are disproportionate to the benefits. I want to make a few notes about the benefits and the burdens. So in some sense, the benefits and burdens are considered narrowly because what the church instructs us is to consider the benefits and the burdens of the treatment itself, not of the patient's life. So if we consider a child who has significant disabilities, who will never walk or talk, but who develops appendicitis and needs an antibiotic. It would be wrong to skip the antibiotic because the child needs significant care. In this case, the need for significant care is not the result of the treatment itself. So again, we're directed to consider the benefits and the burdens of the treatment itself, not other difficulties involved with the care of the patient. On the other hand, the notion of benefits and burdens is fairly broad, as we can see in the ERD language. So the ERDs direct us to consider benefits and burdens not only to the patient, but also to the family and the community. As well, we're considering not just medical benefits and burdens, but benefits and burdens more broadly considered. So psychological, social, spiritual, financial, ERD specifically mentioned, right, as an example of a burden. One of you mentioned that as well when I first asked the question. Okay, so let's see if you're tracking so far. So antibiotics, are they ordinary or extraordinary?
Yeah.
Anyway, say more. What are you thinking?
It would depend on how expensive they are and how accessible and stuff like that.
Okay. Yeah. Any other? Did anyone else say? I heard another. Maybe it depends somewhere.
Well, reasonable hope of benefit. It's not obvious that they would benefit necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. So this is kind of like typical response, right? Because we're thinking like, well, yeah, of course, like if we're prescribed antibiotics, we should take them kind of thing. Like it's just kind of simple. But yeah, it depends. It depends. The answer to any question, is X treatment ordinary or extraordinary? The answer is always it depends, because we have to consider the benefits and the burdens for the particular patient in the particular situation. And so, yeah, the question of whether there's a reasonable hope for a benefit, that's going to depend on the patient. Even if typically if it's prescribed, there is a reasonable hope of benefit, right? Is there an excessive burden? Again, that's going to depend on the patient and the circumstances. Okay, so just to give some obvious examples here, maybe, or I intend these to be obvious, but there could be other factors that I, you know, would change it. But if we consider an otherwise healthy person who is prescribed antibiotics to treat pneumonia, right? Again, if there aren't other complicating factors, it seems like this could very well be ordinary means, versus if we consider someone who is dying from another cause and they develop an infection, well, here the antibiotics might very well be extraordinary, that it might be the case that it's very, very likely that they'll die before the antibiotics would be effective, that the antibiotics might just cause unnecessary suffering in their final hours or days.
Yeah. Like in the ordinary category, the antibiotics will treat pneumonia and another one. There's an alternative therapy. I would imagine it's obligatory to do something, but it would be a prudential judgment call, I suppose, between one or the other, if there's an alternative method, right?
Yeah.
You got to do something, but it's your call on which one.
It's a good question. So, I mean, I think the strict obligation comes in like life-saving cases. But I think you're right that outside of that, there's sort of other prudential considerations as far as alternatives. And I mean, I know, you know, when I was a kid, I always had ear infections and I had antibiotics, you know, every other week. Whereas now I know, well, I mean, doctors still do like to prescribe them very quickly. But what the literature shows is actually most cases resolve on their own. And so you don't actually need to treat. I mean, there you might say, well, maybe it is a question that, you know, the benefits actually don't outweigh the burdens. There are risks. There are, you know, factors. Antibiotics effect don't just have like immediate consequences, but have like long-term consequences on the gut microbiome, right? So, so you might be able to kind of say like, well, it's actually not a clear-cut case, even though we sometimes act like it is. But the other thing is that I think that this principle of obligation comes more into play more obviously with life-saving treatment. Yeah. But I think it's a principle that generally works as well for medical treatment decision-making. Yeah, so maybe I actually want to revise that and say that it would just be a matter of weighing the benefits and burdens differently in those cases, right? If you have another treatment, Or if a wait-and-see approach is acceptable, well, then it's not clearly the case that the benefits outweigh the burdens. So maybe I would want to say that. Yeah, thanks. That's a good question. The accommodation for the doctrine of faith characterizes the considerations involved in determining whether a treatment is ordinary or extraordinary this way. It says in their declaration on euthanasia, it will be possible to make a correct judgment as to the means by studying the type of treatment to be used, its degree of complexity or risk, its cost and the possibilities of using it, and comparing these elements with the result that can be expected, taking into account the state of the sick person and his or her physical and moral resources. I want to draw our attention to that last line, right? The physical, taking into account the physical and moral resources of the patient. It seems to me that this would include how well a patient is able to bear the burdens, how well a patient is able to suffer. So again, exactly what the benefits and the burdens are and how these are weighed against each other will vary to some extent from patient to patient, and even for the same patient at different times, even when we're considering the exact same medical treatment. Here's what Pope Pius XII said about the need to consider the benefits and burdens of treatment for the particular patient in his or her particular circumstances. He says, normally one is held to use only ordinary means according to the circumstances of persons, places, times, and cultures. That is to say, means that do not involve any grave burden for oneself or others or another. A more strict obligation would be too burdensome for most people and would render the attainment of higher, more important good too difficult. Life, health, all temporal activities are in fact subordinated to spiritual ends. So in the first part of the quote, he mentions cultural circumstances. So here I think what he has in mind is variation in cultural norms, support, resources that alleviate or worsen the burdens of treatment, right? So, I mean, one thing in the U.S. that is very different from, say, in some other countries like Latin American countries is that, you know, sort of we don't have intergenerational families living together. That's not the norm. And so burdens of medical treatment can be a lot greater when you have these isolated, you know, family units rather than lots of other family members around to help out. So just one example that comes to mind as far as what he might have in mind for cultural variation. The other thing I want to note in this quote is that he gives a reason why the tradition instructs us to weigh the benefits and burdens. He says that a more strict obligation would be too burdensome, would render the attainment of other goods too difficult. Here's an example, I think, to help us think through how this applies, right? So if we think about chemotherapy, and this ties us back to the case, right, to Jenny's case. When we have cases where chemo is only going to extend life, especially for a short period of time, and chemo we know there's many sufferings, right, that it causes, physical as well as psychological. So certainly it could be the case that a patient, given that diagnosis, could forgo chemotherapy in order to focus on these more important goods, right? Preparation for death, spending time with one's family. And in the case of Jenny, this is part of her consideration. So one thing was the physical side of it for her, that she actually was not in good enough health to really, even from a medical perspective, she wasn't in good enough health to really medically go through with it, that the doctors thought she was in too weak of a condition at the time of the diagnosis. But she also was considering that she really did want to spend time with her family, and she actually wanted to go back to her home country to see her other children before she died, which is a very reasonable decision in this case, right? She's focusing on these other goods, these relational goods, even though she could have pursued a treatment that would have given her a little bit of a longer life, possibly. So it is morally permissible to withhold or withdraw medical treatment when the burdens, including physical and moral suffering, if we draw from JP2's terminology, so including the physical and moral suffering caused by the treatment, when those burdens are disproportionate to the benefits, as we've discussed. But what if a patient's suffering is caused not by a treatment, but by an underlying medical or even psychiatric condition, right? In that case, we don't have a path of withdrawing or withholding the treatment in order to alleviate or not to impose the burdens. So how then can we alleviate suffering? One way of alleviating suffering offered by society today is euthanasia. So from the church defines euthanasia, and here's again a moral definition, which doesn't quite align with the medical one, but we'll come to that in a minute. The church defines euthanasia as an action or an omission which of itself or by intention causes death in order that all suffering may in this way be eliminated. So note what falls under this definition. So it says an action or omission. So first an action. So again, it's an action which causes death in order to alleviate suffering. So this, the intention is actually good, right? Or it's not obviously wrong, right? It's good, like we said, there are many cases in which it's good to alleviate suffering. So the intention is good. But it's an action that directly aims at life. So there's the problematic part. Directly aims against life, right? Taking human life. So that's the problematic part of the action. So what kind of actions come to mind when we directly aimed at life? Well, physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia in the legal or the medical senses. The difference is who performs the final action. So physician-assisted suicide, the medical provider prescribes the lethal medication, but the patient has to be the one to take it, him or herself. Euthanasia, the medical provider both provides the means and then also carries out the final action, injecting the lethal medication. So that's the medical legal distinction there. In the U.S., euthanasia is not legal anywhere in the medical sense. Physician-assisted suicide is legal somewhere around 14 states. What state are we in? We're in D.C. It's legal in D.C., actually. Not in Rhode Island, though. Euthanasia is legal in other countries around the world. Closest to us is in Canada, which is fairly recent. Okay, so physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia in the legal medical sense both fall under this moral definition. But the moral definition is actually broader than this. So an omission, right? So what do we mean by that? Well, if we withdraw or withhold ordinary means, right? So these means are obligatory. So if we don't pursue them, then we're omitting treatment in a problematic way. What about the intention part, right? So of itself or by intention. So here's where I think even withdrawing or withholding extraordinary means with the intention of causing death would fall under this, right? So withdrawing or withholding extraordinary means, our intention has to be to either alleviate or not to impose additional suffering of the treatment, right? But we can't directly aim at death of the patient. So even though we're not acting or omitting something which directly causes death, right, in the case of extraordinary means, we're doing it by intention. As mentioned earlier, Catholic teaching is clear that euthanasia in the moral sense, again, including all those different variations that we just talked through, is morally wrong. So in John Paul II's encyclical Evangelium Vitae, which is an encyclical on life issues, he says, "I confirm that euthanasia is a grave violation of the law of God, since it is the deliberate and morally unacceptable killing of a human person." And then he gives the basis for this teaching. So the doctrine is based upon the natural law. Natural law involves acknowledging the basic goods, life, procreation, knowledge, and sociability, like we talked about earlier, and then putting that together with what Aquinas calls the first precept of the natural law, do good and avoid evil. So we should promote the goods, life, procreation, knowledge, and sociability, and not act directly against them. That's what the evil would be. So it would fall under the natural law. It would be a direct action against the good of human life. So it's based upon the natural law and upon the written word of God, so scripture. is transmitted by the church's tradition and taught by the ordinary and universal magisterium. So it's saying that this is based in the natural law, but also in scripture and the tradition of the church. The church does recognize, and I think it's important to keep this in mind. So the church, just like in cases of suicide, outside of the medical context, the church does explicitly recognize that moral responsibility may be reduced or absent in cases of physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia. So the church is very cognizant that sometimes people are really suffering unbearably. There might be societal pressures, financial pressures, these sorts of things that can certainly mitigate the responsibility of the person. So this is that objective-subjective distinction that maybe you've encountered for other Catholic teaching, right? So the church isn't saying in these cases that physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia are permissible or good. They're still objectively wrong. But the church is saying that as far as whether the individual is responsible before God, right, that could be mitigated by these other circumstances. Like I said, the church is very cognizant of the difficulty, right, of the suffering involved in these different medical situations and end-of-life care. Here's a quote from the ERDs, recognizing the difficulty both for the individuals, also for the families, the caregivers, the friends. It says, above all, as a witness to its faith, a Catholic healthcare institution will be a community of respect, love, and support to patients or residents and their families as they face the reality of death. What is hardest to face is the process of dying itself, especially the dependence, the helplessness, and the pain that so often accompany terminal illness. I think the same could be said also of non-terminal illness. And so the church then calls us to respond to the suffering in these situations. The CDF's Declaration on Euthanasia says that the pleas of gravely ill people who sometimes ask for death are not to be understood as implying a true desire for euthanasia. In fact, it is almost always a case of an anguished plea for help and love. What a sick person needs, besides medical care, is love, the human and supernatural worth with which the sick person can and ought to be surrounded by all those close to him or her, parents and children, doctors and nurses. I think the ERD language is very simple, it's very beautiful. It says that the task of medicine is to care even when it cannot cure. If we think about really the first healthcare, historically, the first hospitals, these existed before modern medicine, right? Before we had effective medicine. And the church, the Christians, monasteries are very much, this is the place where this first occurs, right? And so the care, the caring element, actually is sort of the foundation for healthcare, even when cures are not available, even when they were not available. I'll end this section on euthanasia with a note on compassion, rightly understood. So compassion, that word compassion, I think it's come up a few times in the talks, but we maybe haven't defined it that clearly. Etymologically, we have the passion part, which refers to suffering. So, and the come with. So compassion like literally means to suffer with. So again, another quote from GP2's letter Evangelium Vitae. He says, even when not motivated by a selfish refusal to be burdened with the life of someone who is suffering, euthanasia must be called a false mercy and indeed a disturbing perversion of mercy. True compassion leads to sharing another's pain. It does not kill the person whose suffering we cannot bear. So he's responding here to sort of arguments put forward in our society, right, that euthanasia is a compassionate action. He's saying this is not, or it's not suffering with that person. This quote is an article by Richard Dorflinger. It is entitled The Good Samaritan and the Good Death, Catholic Reflections on Euthanasia. And he puts this idea of compassion in conversation with the story of the Good Samaritan. So I think this is also really beautiful and helpful. He says, to put the Christian rejection of suicide and euthanasia in terms more suited to the Good Samaritan story, our call in times of hardship and suffering is to reach out in solidarity with the sufferer and make ourselves his or her neighbor. To end that patient's life is to push him or her away from us, to end our relationship of solidarity, even if it is done with the most altruistic of motives. We make the person no longer our neighbor. We cannot have compassion. We cannot suffer with someone who is no longer here. He also makes this point about how our actions shape us, right? How they affect us. All of our actions also have an impact on us, right? So he says, making ourselves directly and deliberately responsible for our neighbor's death. So here, maybe he has in mind like the healthcare providers, right, who are prescribing lethal medication, or family members who might be on board with the patient's decision. So it's not an action that will build up in us the character able to reach out to the victim by the roadside, bind up his wounds, and take him with us to a place of rest and safety. Okay, so I think I'll go through this section kind of quickly, and then we can maybe say more about it in the Q&A if you'd like to. So in addition to suffering with those who suffer, we can also use medical means of alleviating suffering. So we can use pain medication more broadly. We can turn to what we refer to as palliative care. So this would be part of the response, the right response to suffering of those who are sick or at the end of their lives. Okay, so what is palliative care? So palliative care is clinical care that focuses on symptom management, improving quality of life of patients, and overall sort of the big picture. So what do we mean by that? So in today's medical world, we have specialties and subspecialties, and we don't do a great job of helping patients who see different specialists to understand how all the different things they're told fit together. So that's the big picture, right? So I have an example. I was once on sort of a consult for a case where a patient was dying, and the family did not understand the patient was dying. I think they had some sense, like things weren't looking good. But the cardiologist comes in and says, heart looks good. And so the family took this to mean, wow, the patient has had a turnaround and might be able to come home, right? Which wasn't the case. But that's just a very striking example, right, of how we lose the big picture sometimes with all these different specialization. Palliative care helps to connect those different pieces. So it can refer to kind of any medical care that does these different things, but it's also considered itself to be a specialty. So physicians and advanced practice nurses and can receive specialized care in palliative care. So again, they're focused on symptom management, quality of life improvements, helping patients and families to understand the big picture. I can probably go through this. I'll just go a little quickly here. So what are the benefits of palliative care? So maybe as expected, since this is what they focus on, we do know that patients have better control of symptoms when they're receiving palliative care, that they have a better understanding of their diagnosis, better communication. One thing that's kind of striking, maybe not that surprising though, is that patients actually live longer when they are receiving palliative care. So maybe just kind of, again, maybe not that surprising, because if you think like if you're feeling better, like you might live longer, right? So, but studies actually show this, that is true, that we live longer. So what's the difference then between, you might think, palliative care and hospice? Like maybe you've heard both of these terms, you're not quite sure the difference. So hospice, think of as a part of palliative care. So it's kind of, palliative care is broader. And so both, again, are focused on the things I talked about, quality of life. Both have been shown to improve survival. So patients who are in hospice also are shown to live longer. They provide additional layer of care by specialists. Both can be provided in the home. But essentially, hospice is limited to terminal cases. So palliative care, anyone can receive palliative care who could benefit from palliative care. Hospice in the U.S. is tied to medical insurance. It's a medical insurance benefit. And so a patient has to have a diagnosis of 6 months or fewer to live. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so it's part of palliative care. So again, it's part of this specialty of medicine focused on quality of life, symptom management. But it's specifically for patients who are in an end-of-life situation. It can be provided in the home. So if somebody is living at home, you would have members of the hospice team stop by, during the week. Or sometimes there are hospice homes. So if a patient also has this terminal diagnosis, so 6 months or fewer to live, that patient can be, instead of in a traditional nursing home, can be specifically in a hospice home where all of the providers there have this specialized training. The other difference with hospice care is that there is a shift to comfort care. So with palliative care is absolutely compatible with aggressive medical treatment. Palliative care doesn't at all indicate that you have sort of stopped pursuing treatment-oriented therapy, whereas for hospice, generally speaking, that you do make that shift to focusing on comfort rather than curative treatment. So again, as far as who can receive palliative care, typically there's a lot of sort of misunderstandings that we often sort of conflate palliative care and hospice, and we think it's also limited to end-of-life situations. That's not true, but certainly patients who do have a terminal diagnosis often are good candidates for palliative care in addition to hospice. Anyone who has a life-limiting chronic illness could benefit from palliative care is also a candidate. But palliative care, as I've said, is actually open to anyone who could benefit from it. So there's actually no requirement that you have a terminal diagnosis or even that you have a life-limiting condition. Okay, so I'm just kind of going through this because there are a lot of misconceptions about palliative care and hospice, including from physicians, right? So I mean, it wasn't atypical. We had an amazing palliative care team in the hospital we worked. And it wasn't atypical that, if the conversation came up about palliative care with the family, that the family would sort of react very negatively, like, oh, no, we're not there yet. You're not there to benefit from better pain control, right? Better quality of life. But physicians sometimes also had that response. So there's just misunderstandings all around. So what does the Catholic Church say about it? So the Catholic Church does specifically speak to palliative care. We see in ERD 60, dying patients who request euthanasia should receive loving care, psychological and spiritual support, and appropriate remedies for pain and other symptoms so that they can live with dignity until the time of natural death. So here, again, an idea that we can and should alleviate pain and suffering. ERD 61, patients should be kept as free of pain as possible so that they may die comfortably and with dignity. So palliative care itself isn't mentioned, but certainly sort of the motivation, right, the focus of palliative care is mentioned. The Catechism mentions it specifically. So the Catechism says palliative care is a special form of disinterested charity. As such, it should be encouraged. This phrase, disinterested charity, you probably come across it before. I always think, like, maybe we should use different language because it sounds kind of weird. Like, love someone, but you shouldn't really care about them. That's not what it means, right? So disinterested charity is that we're not in it for our own benefit, right? We're in it for the good of the other. So that's what the church means when it uses that phrase. But I often have, especially in a more secular context, students just like, this is really strange. So disinterested, yeah, we're not doing it because of what it does for us, right? Okay. So I mentioned these things because I think in Catholic circles, there are sometimes concerns about palliative care and hospice. And I would say that sometimes there are sort of links sometimes between palliative care, hospice, physician-assisted suicide, euthanasia, proponents, right? But I would say that by and large, this isn't the case. Certainly the origins of palliative care and hospice and much of present-day practice is very much compatible with Catholic teaching. And what's really interesting, actually, if you look at physician opinion on physician-assisted suicide in the U.S., is that doctors, it seems that studies show that doctors actually in comparison to non-doctors, are less in favor of physician-assisted suicide. But especially if you look at palliative care physicians. So palliative care physicians are, even compared to other doctors, less in favor, so more opposed to the physician-assisted suicide. It's kind of interesting. The doctors that work most closely with patients who are really suffering are actually more likely to oppose physician-assisted suicide. Okay, this is my last slide. So this brings us full circle a bit with some of the things we've talked about uniting our suffering with Christ's suffering. So this is a quote from the Declaration on Euthanasia again. It says this, "Therefore, one must not be surprised if some Christians prefer to moderate their use of painkillers in order to accept voluntarily at least part of their sufferings and thus associate themselves in a conscious way with the sufferings of Christ crucified." So again, we've talked about suffering as an experience of evil, and so it's permissible, even good, to alleviate suffering. But at the same time, the church recognizes that this is a particularly powerful way of uniting ourselves with Christ, right? And so the church also recognizes that when we are sort of suffering on account of a medical condition, even if that suffering can be alleviated, Christians might choose not to alleviate it or not to alleviate it to the full extent in order to consciously unite this with Christ's suffering. Very next line, though, "Nevertheless, it would be imprudent to impose a heroic way of acting as a general rule." So this goes back to some of the ideas, right, that we don't want to put a heavier burden on people than would be good for them, right? And so the idea here is if you have someone making decisions on behalf of a patient, we don't want to assume or we don't want to impose on them oh, you're a Christian, you should, take some additional, we're not going to give you pain medication. The general approach should be to alleviate pain, unless the patient, him or herself, expresses a wish, to forgo the pain medication.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.